From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Alex Jones' popular show. Jones is a conspiracy theorist who has made lots of money by spreading obviously wrong ideas. And you can laugh at him if you like. Jones tells his audience he believes in weather weapons. He has suggested that the White House can control the weather. He even floated the idea that Hurricane Irma might have been geoengineered. Well, his InfoWars website gets 10 million monthly visits, and I've seen plenty of InfoWars bumper stickers around town. It's popular, but it goes beyond kooky. In 2013, Jones spent a lot of time advancing the idea that the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting was a hoax, or more specifically, that it was a false flag operation staged by gun control advocates and using child actors. He has stated that no one died in the Florida mass shooting this year. Some of Jones's fans have harassed the parents of children murdered at Sandy Hook, and earlier this year, six Sandy Hook families sued Alex Jones for defamation. Now, why are we talking about Alex Jones today? You might have heard that Facebook and YouTube and Apple have decided to deplatform or ban Jones and InfoWars. Several other social media platforms have done the same. Twitter, on the other hand, says it's up to journalists to correct misinformation. A debate has opened up over whether social media platforms should have specific standards before banning someone. Advocates of the ban say that Alex Jones is a monster, profiting off the pain of others and spreading dangerous misinformation. Opponents of the ban say, where does it stop? Should Facebook ban users who shared InfoWars articles too? What's the standard? Our guests this hour are here to debate it. In studio, we have Scott Maloof, an attorney whose work focuses on the intersection of social media and the law. Scott, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Mike Johansson is a lecturer of communication at RIT.
You got it right.
I did get it right.
Good job.
Nice to have you back here.
Thanks for having me.
This is going to be interesting this hour because Mike and Scott are two people who have a ton of experience in this realm and maybe have slightly divergent views on exactly what the right thing to do and what not to do was. But let me just, I'll start with this, Scott. For those out there saying, free speech, you know, you can't, you know, Facebook can't ban Alex Jones, can they? Can they?
Yes.
Okay, that was easy.
It's the last short answer you'll get all hour.
Yeah, they can. Okay, so they can do this.
Yes.
Could they do this if it's considered a public utility, which is part of a future kind of a debate, but we've kind of talked about that already.
We've talked about that. That's a lot of problems for them to come in as a utility. You know,
and it's not right now.
It's not. And the biggest example is the fact that, you know, it's a private company. They were founded with private money as opposed to the utility, which got special rights from the government. And we all, to some extent, participate in the utility.
Okay. So the answer is they can do this. Should they do this, Scott?
You know, this is what I look at the heat that Twitter got for not banning him. And I feel that Twitter's not gotten a fair shake because what they're really looking at is what has he done on our platform? What are our rules? And let's apply them as neutrally as possible. And they have said, we are not in the business of trying to suss out what's true and what's not true. And when you really start thinking about these platforms and what challenges they have, how many users they have, how many posts come up an hour, how difficult it is to determine if something is or isn't true quickly, you can see why Twitter has taken what I would say is a more consistent or easier to understand stance from the position of running a company.
Okay. Mike, should they have done this?
I hate to be wishy-washy, but two answers to that. Number one, no, because all it does is reinforce conspiracy theorists' claims, right?
So when Facebook bans Alex Jones, it reinforces?
The narrative.
Oh, because they're all ganging up on
right. The
one person sharing the truth.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, there's probably other ways you could get at him without actually shutting him down and just reinforcing the narrative. But absolutely, I think this is one of those situations where if you don't take some action against someone who's essentially spreading lies, and I guess from my perspective, as someone who's tried to understand not being from here, tried to understand the First Amendment and all its ramifications, I still truly don't know, and perhaps Scott can enlighten me, about why the First Amendment can be applied to cover someone who is spreading lies. I understand free speech, and in fact, an article that we all looked at earlier where Ted Cruz referred to defending free speech, including offensive speech, bad speech, and stupid speech, nowhere there does it talk about false speech, lies. And that's what's happening here. And I do not understand why the First Amendment would be applied to protecting someone who is spreading lies.
Well, Mike, let me play devil's advocate. And in this case, I might be advocating for the devil. It's possible. I don't know, Alex Jones. I don't think he is. But let me play devil's advocate and just say, when Alex Jones says, I think this mass shooting was a false flag operation, is he lying?
Okay, where's the evidence? Does he ever provide evidence? I mean, the fact
people believe all kinds of stupid things.
I understand. But if he were to take a lie detector test, for example, and we can all get into the virtues or lack thereof of lie detector tests, would he honestly say he believes that? Or would he say, which he has said in a New York Times article yesterday, I spread information that goes to the very edge of what some people believe is accurate, and I think hyperbole is fine.
All right, let me.
Hyperbole is not lying.
I agree.
It can be.
I agree.
It can be, but it's not always.
Okay, but if you spread, the definition of a lie is spreading information that you know to be factually incorrect.
I guess as playing devil's advocate, and Scott's about to jump in with a much more cogent legal approach to this, but do you want to police and parse out whether this hyperbole is a lie, this is just hyperbole for effect, this belief is not grounded in enough fact and is therefore a lie? I mean, that kind of parsing gets very difficult, doesn't it?
I agree, but there's precedent for this. And I would say, for example, when it comes to indecency and pornography, there's a whole bunch of case law, and I'm sure Scott knows far more about it than I do, that relates to community standards. And I believe you could have a community standards situation where judges would make decisions on what is potentially harmful, what potentially is not harmful. I have no problem with people speaking untruths. The flat earthers can say the earth is flat all they want. Where I really have a problem is where the untruth can lead to harm.
Okay, so let's do something here. I'm going to ask the professor questions because that's what every student wants to do. Media covers a lot of criminal cases. So let's say a parent comes out and says, you know, their child has been charged, and the parent says, my child is innocent. Is that a lie or is that true?
Hard to say, right?
Okay, so what about when the charges are filed and all of a sudden the police bring out body camera and video evidence that shows the child committing the crime and the parent says, my child is innocent? Is that a lie?
Have the parents seen the video?
Parents have seen the video, and the media goes and says, and we want a response. Parent says, my child is innocent.
They're sticking up for their kid, however wrong that is. Is it really causing harm?
So you'd say yes or no. Is that a lie?
Sure, it's a lie.
It's a lie. Okay.
Because they've seen the video. They know it's not true.
So then they go to trial. Child is convicted. Parent says, I believe my child. And the parent says, my child is innocent. And they start doubling down and selling T-shirts. Is that a lie? And is that fraudulent to sell those T-shirts to raise money for the appeal?
Sure. I would say absolutely.
And I think there's the problem. You implicitly said there yourself, well, they're the parent, they're the one. That's the difficulty, you know, of determining when that's a lie, because I think all of us would say the parent gets the ability to say that. And look at how much time we'd have to spend to go through. You know, maybe the jury comes back and says this person's not guilty. So is those prior statements after the video vindicated and they're not lies? Should Facebook kick the parent off because the video disproves the parent's statement? That's the challenge, Mike. I think it's easy to say this thing's a lie, you gotta go. But when we live in the real messy world, it's really hard to label what's a lie or not. Mm. Same thing, moon landing. Some people believe we never landed on the moon. Are they all off Facebook?
No, and I'm not saying people should be thrown off for lying per se. What I am saying, and in fact, if I ever were to be a Supreme Court justice, this might be highly unlikely, of course. My interpretation of the First Amendment would be basically that it does protect free speech, but it doesn't protect untruthful speech in so much as that speech has a likelihood of engendering hate or some other serious harm.
You know, and it's funny, you say engendering harm. So what if the person says the existence of this speech that I don't like, you know, the speech that's going on at the rally in Charlottesville, that is psychologically harmful to me. That speech should not, it's false. You know, if they're saying there's a genetic difference between people for some reason and it's harmful to me, is that speech out?
Well, that would depend, right? Show me the evidence. Take it to court.
See, but now you're the one equivocating.
Yeah. By the way, Evan's getting bored sitting over there.
No, I'm not. I'm already reading comments that came in. I mean, so here's Gary saying, well, that didn't take long. First Amendment comes up. Whether this is First Amendment is irrelevant. It's moot. It's not a government issue.
So, he's right. That's right.
So Gary's arguing that this is interesting, but it's not central to what's going on here. And I've got a couple of other emails that are different on the grounds of Alex Jones and the deplatforming. But let me, in the spirit of understanding what's been going on in the last week, read the various explanations given by Facebook, Apple, and YouTube for banning Alex Jones and InfoWars, because they don't line up perfectly snugly, which is interesting. So let me go ahead here. The reason for the bans: Apple announced that it does not tolerate hate speech, and thus Jones had to go. Facebook announced that it had removed Alex Jones's pages for, quote, glorifying violence, which violates our graphic violence policy, and using dehumanizing language to describe people who are transgender, Muslims, and immigrants, which violates our hate speech policies. And YouTube also cited hate speech, but also harassment, as the rationale for knocking down Alex Jones's videos. So hate speech is at the core of all three, but also harassment with one, glorification of violence in another. So it's not a perfectly snug set of rules here that these three companies are announcing for deplatforming Alex Jones. Should that matter to us? Is that a concern that we don't have a single standard for when someone's going to get banned?
Well, I think every company is going to run themselves differently. You know, you have Twitter, which is a much more open environment than a YouTube, which says, you know, we would like to be family friendly. And so everybody's going to have a different set of standards. And remember, inside of all that, Spotify, for example, just blanket banned Alex Jones, whereas some of the others, I think it was Apple, took down most of his podcasts, but not all of them.
Okay. And, you know, I'm looking at this saying, Mike Johansson, if you are comfortable with the decisions made to ban, are you comfortable that future decisions to ban would be held in consistent regard there? Because Alex Jones isn't going to be the only one who has offended or has, quote unquote, glorified violence or engaged in hate speech based on the standards of these companies. Do you think they will apply those equally?
You would hope they would, but another reason for that perhaps it wasn't such a great idea to necessarily take them down is, in a sense, this is a multi-headed hydra. You whack off one head, 10 more pop up. The number one news app right now on the Apple Store is the InfoWars app. It went from a few hundred downloads a week to tens of thousands a day the minute they got shut down elsewhere. So you're not really shutting it down completely. You're just shutting it down on places. And I can see Facebook's perspective. You're shutting down places where people might find it, or YouTube, or people might find it truly offensive. If you really want to go find it, you still can.
And I think, you know, this is an easier... We're doing the easy thing for two reasons. You know, one, we're just talking about the platforms. We're not talking about some of the services that protect websites and keep them up. You know, Daily Stormer had this come up where I think it was Cloudflare is a company that protects websites from attacks. And they kicked off Daily Stormer, the Nazi website. And the CEO of Cloudflare said, is that right? I'm providing this vital service and I'm deciding who gets this service. And without me, they may not exist at all. And the second thing is, I would say, to me, this issue is the French fry problem, right? You go to your doctor, and the doctor says, Evan, your cholesterol's too high. You got to quit eating French fries. And you're upset, you know, and you say, I want something. And that's why InfoWars gets, you know, huge downloads. Whereas if you, Evan, said to yourself, you know what, my cholesterol's too high, I'm going to stop eating French fries. Have I not, at this age in my life, eaten every single French fry I ever need to eat ever again? And you would, you know, you're not going to rush out and try and have those fries. And that's what the banning to me is. It's saying you can't have something, people react and they want it, as opposed to trying to inculcate that better sense to say, this guy has continued to spread information that's false. He's not trustworthy on any level. Don't even go there. You shouldn't even be told you need to do that.
So before we get some of our feedback from our listeners, where do you think you disagree here, Mike? I mean, you and Scott have some overlap, but where do you think you disagree most strongly?
Well, I think the social media platforms are in a very different position to any other media.
Yeah.
They're worldwide. They have enormous reach and enormous power. They have algorithms known only to themselves. And the fact of the matter is that if they say they are... I wouldn't say welcome these kinds of people in, but if they're okay with having them there, they have to have some serious concerns about the possible consequences of them, these places like InfoWars, really going off the deep end. I mean, it's crazy what they do right now, but how crazy would they get before Facebook actually had to pull the plug?
And, right. and picking up on what Mike said, another problem is as these platforms become more and more important, you know, right now we're talking about Facebook, but if we start talking about a Venmo, which is a financial services platform, or Uber, you know, if you say to folks in New York City, hey, you can't use Uber because of some reason you've been kicked off, the driver's been kicked off, and these essential services start falling away for these non-transparent reasons. Now we're seeing huge real-world problems that we're not addressing and we're not going to be able to address.
Let me read some of the dissent that we have seen in various quarters. And I don't want to overgeneralize the dissent on these bans. Listeners, if you want to weigh in on the decisions by Facebook, YouTube, Apple to ban Alex Jones and InfoWars, or Twitter's decision, at least for now, to say we can't be policing what is true or not, journalists, you got to step up and do the job and fill this void, you can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I don't want to overgeneralize the dissent on what Facebook, YouTube, Apple have done to say, well, it's conservatives who don't like it, because there's plenty of conservatives who have no problem with what they've done as private companies, or saying, look, we may be conservative, but Alex Jones is not one of us. He's a kook, et cetera, et cetera. But Ben Shapiro, writing for National Review, I think sums up what some of their concerns are. It's not necessarily the banning. It's the grounds for the banning. And Shapiro writes the following, quote, I'm far more concerned with social media arbiters suddenly deciding that vague hate speech standards ought to govern our common spaces. Social media giants had a choice here. If they wanted Jones gone, they could simply have defined a standard limit on the number of debunked conspiracy theories one could peddle on the site before being banned, or they could have created a standard prohibiting public threats. Instead, they chose the most politically correct way of booting Jones. They claimed he'd violated undefined standards regarding hate, end quote. And Shapiro does go on to say that conservatives have a distrust of the progressive left, that their concern is that hate speech is going to be used to try to deplatform a lot more than just Alex Jones, and that he wishes it would have been handled differently because the term hate speech is too nebulous. Is it too nebulous, Scott?
Yes. I mean, again, I'm going to give you very simple. There is no definition in the law for hate speech. This is a concept that's kind of come up. The courts don't use it. There is no really good definition. And frankly, I would rather use the phrase hateful speech. Let's look at the intent of the listener. And let's just give a quick example. You know, somebody gets a racist message and from someone. So that was hateful. The intent was to spread, you know, racial animus. The person who gets the message reposts it and says, look at this message I got. This is offensive. This is ridiculous. You know, maybe don't go to this business where this person works. Okay. The second person often will get banned from these social sites, you know, for posting something that's, quote, hate speech. But they had no hateful intent. They had no desire to spread animus based upon race or some other characteristic. But they're out. Because of the algorithms, because of how the sites work. So I think it's a really terrible concept. It hasn't been well thought through. And just as we've seen, a lot of times it gets enforced the wrong way, you know, as opposed to the way it was supposed to do and was supposed to help with.
Mike Johansson, agree or disagree there?
Oh, no, I agree. I agree absolutely with the intent. The problem is, for all these social media platforms, is it's a huge game of whack-a-mole.
Yep.
I mean, they just cannot keep up with the sheer volume of what's being posted. And there is talk that artificial intelligence and machine learning will, you know, start getting much better and better at flagging and pulling this stuff in. And Facebook and Twitter have increased the size of their teams reviewing mm-hmm. material on their sites. But frankly, it's an impossible task.
Right.
They just can't keep on top of it.
Right. And we're also ignoring the human cost for the folks who are screening this stuff and who are just seeing some of the worst and most vile images. And the fact for we as users having stuff come through that's just unreliable. And then we start turning away from the platforms that are not as efficient for us.
Let me get some feedback from listeners. Mike in Brighton is first on the phones. Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, hey. Well, thank you for taking my call, and I really enjoy the program.
Thanks.
I'm not really media hip or computer hip, but I just, you know, use my fancy phone to text. And what is Alex Jones, you know, how much money does he have? And it says $5 million. So I think nothing that's been brought into the conversation at this point is that he's profiting off this. And I think he's profiting off horrible tragedies that have occurred to individual people, families, and in reality, our entire society. and it's a bit disturbing for me.
Okay. Are we to follow the money here? Mac, what do you make?
Well, it's always
That's exactly it. It's like follow the money. This guy is making money off of, you know, making outrageous statements on, you know, the social media or whatever it is. And like you were discussing earlier, because I was listening to the program, there are no facts to back up that, you know, there were child actors at, you know, Sandy Hook.
Even
the latest thing that happened in Florida, and I happen to know where Parkman is, not the particular high school, but I mean that area. It's just, I mean, these families have suffered some of the worst losses possible, and how somebody could have the gumption, or just how you could say these things, which he can't really believe. But hey, if there's a buck behind it for him, I'm gonna do it. And I think that's what's happening.
Yeah, Mike, thank you. I mean, so I'll start with Mike Johansson on this. I do think Alex Jones pretty well proves the point that if you don't really have any scruples or kind of moral grounding, you can be loud and inflammatory and find a way to make that profitable. And that is a sad truth. So does that give us more impetus to try to be proactive in deplatforming people who are that cynical and that predatory?
I guess so, but here's the big question, and this is probably somewhere where Scott and I would actually agree, is that, you know, who are the people who are supporting him? Who are the people who, I think he sells supplements, I think that's how he makes his money.
Right.
Who are the people that are supporting him? Why are they supporting him? You know, why is it that the education system countrywide in the U.S. hasn't taught people enough to be able to discriminate truth from facts and you know, why would so many people flock to support this guy, buy his supplements, and you know, sort of feed the beast, as it were? Truthfully, that's the big puzzle for me.
You know, we agreed on something in under half an hour. I think it's a record. No, Mike's right in the sense of exactly that this is on the consumers, the people who are buying these supplements, to be better as consumers and say, you know, why is this happening? This is emotion. This is inflammatory. I need to turn that off and stop appealing to that. And it's funny. We are all pretty good at sussing out TV commercials and saying, yes, that is the greatest that product is ever going to look in the history of the world. But when it turns to this stuff on social, some people get sucked in. And, you want to say, you, consumer, look at this as a TV commercial. The other thing I want to say is, you know, we've talked a lot about First Amendment, about communities here. Boycotts, you know, nothing prevents people from turning this situation around and using their voice to say, let's start boycotting the supplements or the other products that are supporting his lifestyle and his show.
Before I get another phone call, actually, let's do this. Let me grab John in Rochester on the phone because we're on a similar thread here. And then we're going to turn to a piece that was in the New York Times. Today, about internet trolls. But before we do that, let me get John in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, John.
Hi, thank you. Just as the guests were saying, I think the larger problem isn't so much Alex Jones or people like Alex Jones. It's that there's so much greater an audience for people like Alex Jones than there ever have been, and people who are willing to act on some of these things as if what he's saying is real. I mean, I think it's very much parallel to a lot of the things that happened with our election. Aside from the politics of it and the issues that people were voting on, I can't remember a time when a politician has been held to no standard of truth and continues to be held to no standard of truth. And people are just willing to put up with more things that I think they know aren't true. I don't believe that the majority of the people believe what Alex Jones is saying or even believe what the president is saying. I think they're just willing to go along with it. Why? That I don't know, but they're willing to act on it also. And I think that's happening to such unprecedented levels. That's where I think the difference is. It's more the way people are reacting than people like Alex Jones is the problem.
Yeah, and John, let me ask you a quick question because I'd like to get your take. I think you raise an important point and one that has troubled me, but I think there's sort of two categories of this. So look at just yesterday. Chris Collins, the news comes out, and if you read the indictment against Chris Collins, it's really detailed and thorough, and they have text messages and phone calls and transcripts, and it's very difficult for anybody who has studied insider trading to conclude that there wasn't serious and sort of ham-fisted wrongdoing. And yet instantly you could find Chris Collins supporters saying he's being railroaded. He's being railroaded. In the same way that people will defend President Trump and people defend politicians. We get too emotional about certain things. Mm-hmm. You know, if you loved Barack Obama, for some, it became impossible to believe that there could have been any wrong step. We are too emotional about politics. We are too emotional about public figures to begin with because it closes us down to new information or information that might make us uncomfortable. The difference with Alex Jones, as you point out, well, the issue is the people who believe him. He wasn't a beloved public figure like a political leader. He gained a following for people who were somehow vulnerable to believing really wildly, obviously wrong and inflammatory stuff. And I don't know why someone gets to that point. Do you, John? Can you figure out why? What is it that makes someone vulnerable to believing that the White House controls the weather and that a hurricane was geoengineered? What is it? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I think it's my opinion is it's a minority of people that actually believe it. But I think what the issue is kind of the way that you even broached that question. I think most people, reasonable people, as subjective as that term is, there, what you instantly want to do is draw some kind of reasonable parallel that absolutely that there are people that were such fans of Barack Obama or any politician, Democrat or Republican, that they're willing to look the other way and not view things objectively. But as soon as you start making that parallel and discussing like this, it sounds like, you know, it's equal and it's not equal.
Okay.
That's the problem. Is it's very difficult when you start calling out things that are so incredibly unequal. There's so many people now willing to say, oh, well, you're just biased against the president or biased against the person that I don't agree with. And they always have to draw some kind of parallel. And there's so many people now willing to draw these parallels. And I honestly don't believe they think it's true. I think that, and again, this is what I don't know. I'm sorry I'm not answering your question directly, but I don't understand why people that I know don't believe these things are true, why they're willing to not hold them accountable for saying things that aren't true and then themselves act on it through votes or through tuning in. That is what I don't understand. I hope that made sense.
Yeah, and John, I thank you for this. Thoughts from our guests. Go ahead.
You know, one aspect I would add, or two aspects I would add, that are unique to online culture. One, speed. You know, that Chris Collins news broke, and instantly you started to see people commenting and resharing it. So speed is a problem, because when you have time to reflect, even 20 minutes, you know, it does give you more ability to think and parse out your thought. The second problem is the disintermediation. You know, when you interact with people through a screen, you will say things, you will attack in ways you never would do if you were in person. And I think those two problems are why some of our online culture is so crass. And some of that is porting itself offline.
That's very wise. And by the way, I have found myself doing it at times. It makes me uncomfortable when I do it. And that's a very, very wise point. On the subject, Mike, of just using social media wisely, Scott's right. The Chris Collins news travels at the speed of light, and all of a sudden everyone has an opinion. My first goal was, I'd like to read the full indictment. Now, and I will qualify my comments.
And you're probably an exception to the rule.
Well, I will qualify my comments on the air today by saying, if the FBI is inventing text messages or is fabricating or is entrapping in a way that is not outlined in the indictment, then I'll walk it back. But if what I'm seeing in the indictment is accurate, This looks like a slam dunk.
And here's the irony, is we've never had more access to foundational documents. You can watch the New York State courts all the way up to the Court of Appeals, not the trial of courts, Court of Appeals, the intermediate courts. You can watch oral argument online at home. You can see the documents that are posted by either reporters or in the court systems, you know, and that's true for many, many organizations. So that's the frustrating part. That's why people really have got to change their habits and say, let me read this indictment or let me read a trusted news source. I mean, the one big rule we're talking about, takeaways, is if you can't identify where some source's office is or you don't know where they are, you know, within about 5 seconds, then maybe you shouldn't look at that source. Why don't you start with someplace that you know where their building is?
But reading an indictment takes time, and I could be commenting in that time. By the way, Mike Johansson, I will say I did get an email from a listener who wants to know, for your guest who thinks that Facebook should have banned Alex Jones, who else does your guest think that they should be banning?
I don't have any particular list of people at all. I mean, and the thing for me about smart social media use is to only connect to people that you're either interested in what they have to say, people you know, but by all means connect to people you disagree with, but don't connect with them just so they can upset you. If you sort of get my drift. If I want to know what Alex Jones is saying, there's plenty of ways I can find it without connecting with them on Facebook. To be perfectly honest.
Yeah, and you're the one making the point here that when Facebook bans Alex Jones, there's actually a possible boon to conspiracy theorists to begin with who say, look, everyone is out to get us.
Right.
Instead of saying, look, if you want to spout all the ridiculous stuff in the world, you can do that to an extent. But we're going to better educate the public on discourse, social media usage, which you have always espoused. So isn't the consistent thing to say, don't ban them. Let's not create a slippery slope where we don't have really cogent standards to follow, but let's better educate people on why they believe some of this wacky stuff to begin with.
Sure. Or let's get down in the mud. Let's have a GoFundMe for a counter-programming psychological warfare against Alex Jones, where we start spreading stories that Alex Jones is really funded by George Soros just to get the left up in arms.
All right.
There you go, folks. The theory on XXI.
Now, Mike is here with some actual helpful ideas when it comes to dealing with trolls. And after we take our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about that. And if you want to join the conversation, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. We are talking about Facebook and Apple and YouTube's decision to ban Alex Jones and InfoWars while Twitter decides not to, and a conversation about whether those are the right or wrong decisions. Mike Johansson's a lecturer of communication at RIT. Scott Maloof, an attorney whose work focuses on the intersection of social media and the law. We're right back here on Connection. Coming up in our second hour, the Summer of Food takes a look at coffee culture in Rochester and the Finger Lakes region. Joe Bean opened in 2011 and is getting ready to close its coffee shop, but many others have risen to join Joe Bean in the so-called third wave of coffee. What does it mean? Are you comfortable in those spaces? How do we elevate culture when it comes to food and drink? A conversation centered on coffee next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Mike Johansson's pointing us to a New York Times article. So if you're on the phone, hang there for a second. We're going to get back to the emails and phone calls in a moment. But this piece, read the title first, because how timely is this?
The title is "The Internet Trolls Have Won. Get Used to It."
The trolls have won. Everyone get off the internet. But if you're not going to get off the internet, or if you can't, What are some of the ideas there, Mike, and why did you grab that article?
Okay, so it's the Personal Tech column by Brian Chen, who does a weekly column on personal tech. And this time he frankly admits he normally offers lots of advice and solves problems. This week he just realizes that it's a pretty unsolvable problem. What he says is that a lot of people are on the internet doing things they wouldn't do elsewhere because it's filling a gap in their lives. They don't get enough recognition in their real lives, so they go online and they feel that they can get some recognition by commenting on things, liking things, and they get that little reward system that they're not getting elsewhere. And he says, you know, the internet becomes an easy outlet for us to shout something and feel for a moment fulfilled, even though we're really just shouting out into the air. This is nothing new, of course. Before the internet, people took their frustrations to TV and radio talk shows. The internet was simply a more accessible, less moderated space. So, true, right? So what he suggests towards the end, there isn't a whole lot you can do. However, all the sites have places you can report bad actors and bad content. And you should absolutely get familiar with how to do that. I probably do this at least once or twice a day. I see something I know is not accurate or something that's hateful or something that I just, you know, think is in very poor taste, and I'll flag it. I'm doing my little bit of social media citizenship. The other thing is to find out ways to verify. Literally spend time looking at things and go verify things. Funny story, yesterday, there's a story that was all over social media about how an asbestos company in Russia was putting a stamp, Donald Trump approved, on all the bales of asbestos because the EPA recently reapproved asbestos as a building material. So as a way of thanking him, this people were saying, oh, this has got to be fake, got to be fake, got to be fake. And then people are just literally posting the link to the Snopes, which is a fact-checking site, saying, yep, no, it's actually real. This company really did put Donald Trump's face all over their bales of asbestos.
Okay. Okay. I do think the whole not getting enough of what we need offline in the quote-unquote real world, in real life, is really poignant and important.
Yeah.
I think you've raised that point on this program before.
Yeah, and I think people just have to understand that, you know, it can't be a substitute for in real life.
Right.
And I tell my students this all the time, that, you know, it's fine to say things and be someone on social media, but if you're not being your authentic self and you're not actually getting out in the real world, boy, you're missing a lot.
And I think for parents, you really got to think about this as early as you can. When your kids say, I would like a phone and I want to get social media accounts, you really have to have this discussion about how that pop of popularity, those likes, really are not in real life. They're not substantial. 6 months from now, if you got rid of your phone, would any of those likes mean anything to you?
Yeah. Or well, again, put on your tombstone, this guy got 15 million likes during his lifetime.
Somebody will. Somebody might be doing that now.
Mike Johansson, idea generator today. You picked out three startups.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get back to some feedback here. A couple quick emails and then some phone calls. Ernest writes to us and says, some people believe Alex Jones based on fear. They are fearful of losing something that they believe they possess. I'm currently reading Martha Nussbaum, Monarchy of Fear. Interesting. Thank you, Ernest, for that. Teresa says, Evan, to me, the old saying about pornography applies. I know it when I see it. Hate speech, I know it when I hear it. From Teresa.
Yeah, I think that is a good example. You know, for example, context. You know, the message I had discussed earlier, where one person sent it to another with the intent to hurt, as opposed to the second person calling it out, right? And a lot of that, we're good at that as humans. AI, not good at that. Platforms, not good at that, you know. And Germany, for example, has a hate speech law. And you're seeing that the default, I think, for a lot of what Facebook would do is to say, just take things down, even if they're close, because it costs so much to figure out the issue.
Okay. Let me get Rich in Rochester next. Go ahead, Rich.
Well, to the point of the Alex Jones, I think Facebook and iTunes does have the right to do what they did if they want to police, you know, if we don't want garbage out there. But then Twitter also has the right to allow it to go on. I think in the end, as individuals, just like going to a library, you have to decide what you're going to read and what you're not going to read. Another statement I want to make, though, and I've been leaning toward this lately, is we seem to constantly criticize people who use media, you know, like all the internet media and Facebook and all that. And is that more a older Luddite type attitude? People hated when people read books because it took them into a fantasy world. I think in the end we have to realize this is the new media, and the good and the benefits far outweigh the bad parts if you use it right, just like reading a book. So I don't. This constant attack on being online or on telephones and stuff, I think is misguided. And also, I also disagree with you in this. When you are on Facebook and your friends tell you happy birthday, it means something. So to say because of that person is not saying something to you to your face, or you're not right there intimately with them, it's not real. I think your assessments, I think, are misguided in that way.
Okay.
Did somebody say that?
No.
You said that about likes. You said that about likes. And if someone likes what you say, and you're having a discussion, and you start like there's people that I read on my Facebook page because I like what they say and I like the way they think, and that's real. There's nothing fake about that. There's nothing not real about that. It's no different than reading someone's article, and I think to minimize it because you're not talking to the person. I think that's where I had my problem.
Let's take the happy birthday example, though. I think that's a really good one in the sense of Facebook automates that. And once you put your birthday in, if you're my friend, I get the notices. Whereas 20 years ago, you know, I had to remember your birthday. And so if I called you, texted you, sent you a card, it was a much more substantial act
than
now.
And it was a test.
Right. It was a test. Right.
So, now you can't fail the test with it. And on top of the point that I would just add, sorry to interrupt Scott, because Scott's going to get back on his train in a second. But to Rich, when people say happy birthday, that's nice. It requires almost nothing because Facebook tells you to do it, and to write two words, happy birthday, is one thing. But if someone writes to you, hey, Rich, happy birthday, or if I were to say it to Scott Maloof, I would say, hey, Scott, wishing you, you know, a legal dance party and you know, a publisher who will finally put your legal opus out to the world. That's different because that's personalized. And I think what we do is we do sort of the minimum with social media. You know, oh, I liked this or I wrote happy birthday. But I'm not saying it doesn't have meaning. And Rich, absolutely, I'm not trying to take away meaning away from you when you express that to others or you feel that. But I understand the idea that sort of the minimum.
Well,
kind of the minimum.
Yeah, and let me just weigh in on that too. A like, when you think about it, a like just says somebody liked this post. It doesn't say they actually read it. It doesn't say why they liked it. It doesn't say how meaningful it was to them. They just clicked like. And I'm not diminishing the fact that people who get a lot of likes on a post or whatever, that's fine. It's not the same as 300 people showing up to hear you talk about your new book.
Or just offer a thoughtful response.
Right.
I could say happy birthday, Mike, or I could say wishing you the end of Vegemite as we know it so you can actually improve your food culture. You know, there's lots we could do, more personalized. Scott, anyway, go back to your – I derailed you.
No, that's fine. And I just want to bring up one other point that we haven't talked about, which is this is all a very U.S. perspective, you know, the way we've discussed it. You know, other countries have different standards. But one thing we should be concerned about is we are on the edge of – we are more inclined to allow speech. We're more inclined to allow controversy online. If we start to ban things, you're going to see other parts of the world point to that, especially repressive regimes, and say – well, the U.S. is banning things. Facebook is banning things. So it's okay for us to also censor speech or to use methods to quash it.
I think we probably do get a little bit bogged down in our own perspective sometimes. That's helpful.
But can we just sort of pause there and talk about the difference between censoring speech and calling out misinformation?
Whatever you want. I feel like I do that every time I come here and talk to you.
I'm missing the. You think we don't know the distinction here.
Okay. So censoring speech is saying we disagree or we don't like. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to make maybe it's a hair's breadth distinction between saying, no, this is factually accurate and has no place in the public discourse.
But again, I think that goes back to where we started, which is, who gets to make that determination? How broadly do we define the harm or the falsity that you would, you know, so for example, not equivalent, you know, to Alex Jones at all, but you had Zephyr Teachout recently say, I am going to prosecute ICE, okay? And I am not a criminal lawyer, but her statement, you know, made me kind of scratch my head and say, well, how would you as a state attorney general prosecute a federal agency? Do you mean you'd prosecute the agents themselves? Well, would you have the ability to do that? And again, if somebody's listening who's a criminal lawyer and says she has the ability, please call in and correct me. But to me, on the very surface, that sounds like a claim, you know, that she can't fulfill. And that is, you know, maybe false. So two points. One, we're going to have to put a lot of work into determine if it is false. But two, if you look at the video where that comes out in, you get a really good sense of who she is as a politician, what her policy positions are. So although that one small snippet of a 90-second video maybe could be false, you have gained information to understand, should I vote for this person? Should I not vote for this person? So that's why I had that problem with the falsity standard. You know, there's another example. There was a politician in California who her family is from Cambodia originally. She put up an ad and it talked about the Cambodian genocide. And that ad was bounced from Facebook because they said, you know, this violates our policies, I believe, with regard to violence. And she then went on and said, I'm a conservative and I'm being kicked off Facebook and now making a big story about that. And so she's kind of manipulating, in my view, the system instead of saying, gee, I could have really, you know, talked about the Cambodian genocide, but not used this video. And now I'm, quote, the victim. So it kind of circles back to where you are when you talked about people claiming they're the victim because of the rules instead of us getting to the underlying thing. Are you a good candidate or are you not a good candidate?
We got a flood of feedback. We're going to try to get through as much as we can. Dan in Webster is next on the phone. Go ahead, Dan.
Hey, everybody. Because I feel like I've probably spent more time among these communities than probably you guys have, I just wanted to, like, clue you in to a fact that, like, Alex Jones is persona non grata among much of conspiracy and truther communities. Hmm. He's long been pointed out for ranting and raving and going on without offering any solutions beyond his, you know, founding father mythologies and taking our country back. A lot of people look at him as poisoning the well. And I was wondering what your panel thinks about, because we're talking about truth and lies, what they think about the concept of it being harder to know the truth than to spot a lie. Because I think a lot of people, they don't know what the truth is, but they feel strongly or sometimes know that they're being lied to. What do you guys think about that?
That's an interesting distinction. Scott Malouf?
Yeah, I think that it can be very difficult to know what is 100% correct, what's factual, versus, you know, my gut says, or this seems to be false. And that's a really good example of the work we end up doing on the internet. That's why Snopes is so valuable. That's why Facebook, I think, is going to Snopes, because you have people doing the legwork to say, here's the story, what is true and what is false. And the true part can be a ton of work.
And true, also, I don't mean to sort of get really weird here, but if Scott steals $100 from me and I have it on video, that's true. He did that. But if you tell me this policy will work better to alleviate poverty, there's not really an answer of truth there that we can measure in the same way. It's different. And so when people feel like there is no truth, there is truth,
yeah.
But there's also, you know, different issues on which what we can then try to remove the word truth from and talk about facts as we know them versus truth. And I think it's easier, Mike, you're right, as Dan says, it's easier just to say, I don't know what the truth is here, but I know that this is wildly off the map here.
Sure, sure. And then, you know, and to go back to your example, then, you know, if you're talking about a policy is going to make a big difference. If you can point to a historical record of this particular policy working, then you've got facts. If it's something brand new, then you're going to have to take it on faith.
Yeah, very interesting, as always, Dan. Thank you. Greg in Fairport, we got to keep it tight now. Go ahead, Greg.
All right, a couple quick questions. I'll take your listen to it off the air. I feel like part of this was started when Facebook removed the don't like from their service. People didn't have a chance to argue the antithesis. They just had to like or make a comment. Two, I think what happened is they've martyred Alex Jones. I didn't know who this guy was from a bag of apples until the news came out. Then I went and looked at him. I don't have an opinion on him one way or the other, but I didn't know him until that all came up. And last is the comment is the overall population. If this guy's getting millions and millions of hits, who are these people and why do they feel that way? Has something happened? Has something changed? Is there a real negative attitude in our population that we're just not touching at? And if so, why? Is it is it generated by the web, the media, mm-hmm. the movies, the TVs we see? I mean, why is this such a negative atmosphere out there? Thanks very much.
Greg, thank you. I mean, I think that last question is an interesting one because it is parallel to the questions on, well, why did Donald Trump get traction? Why do some candidates who aren't chosen by the establishment get traction? It's when I think establishment structures don't do a good job of servicing entire populations where people start to look elsewhere for answers. And sometimes they alight on some really good ideas and sometimes they alight on some really bad kooky stuff.
Sure.
Oh, I was just going to add real quickly. And to the negativity point, the online platforms are fantastic at negative. You know,
yeah.
You get bounced from a flight, you know, hey, at Delta, you did this to me.
Yeah.
As opposed to you see very few tweets that say, thank you, Delta, you got me here 10 minutes early.
We should do more of that, by the way. That's another good takeaway. Do more of that. Go ahead.
Well, the other thing, too, is both the strength and the great weakness of the internet is it brings together people of like-mindedness who at once were kind of in isolation. If there are 100,000 people in all of the United States who think that going back to the Stone Age would be an ideal, they now can get together on the internet. And you know,
for a limited time,
ironically enough, yes. And so you can bring all these communities together. So if I'm thinking a particular way, and I can go out there, I can literally frame my whole world around my particular way of thinking. I can find more people like that. I get more reinforcement, and the reinforcement cycle gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And The big challenge here, I think, is educators, everyone, we all need to start getting out of our comfort zone and learning about other perspectives.
Yeah. Jillian and Geneseo, a minute left. Sorry to do this to Scott Maloof, but she says, First Amendment doesn't apply to private enterprise, or at least she's making the point of the difference on the First Amendment. But she says, does this change if Alex Jones's listeners then act on his bad information? And then she says, does this then become yelling fire in a movie house law?
Well, let's take that last part.
You only got about 40 seconds.
We got
good
40
luck.
Seconds. So that comes from United States versus Schenck, which is next year will be 100 years old. That was really just a rhetorical flourish by the Justice Holmes, who said he justified suppressing people protesting the First World War. A year later, he turned around and he said that was a bad decision. And that rule has been used ad nauseum, that soundbite, for almost 100 years to justify nebulous limits on the First Amendment.
Okay. So when we hear yelling fire in a crowded theater, it has an interesting backstory.
Yeah. It's not a good tool to think about speech.
Okay. Well, we should probably do a whole hour on the history of yelling fire in a crowded theater and how it gets understood sometimes properly, sometimes improperly, and what the intent of the remark was. That would be interesting, wouldn't
it? That would be fun.
Our thanks, as always, to Scott Maloof and Mike Johansson for coming in, debating these issues, and putting some light at a time where there's a lot of public discourse about what Facebook, Twitter, I don't even think we got into, I don't know what Instagram, you know, like the different platforms, what they're doing about Alex Jones, InfoWars, and more. And I have a feeling it's going to be an ongoing conversation. So I'll see you both soon.
Look forward to it.
Sounds good.
And you know what I'm taking from this? I'm going to tell the company the next time I interact with the business, I'm going to say something positive about it. Much more connections coming up.